I'm going to give you a brief rundown of what it is that we're going to be listening to on the prepared portion of tonight's program. It's going to be a long prepared portion, so hang on to your hats. We're going to start off, by the way, this broadcast is the second program in a two-part archive series called Why Johnny Can't Identify Il Duce. That was the title of a San Francisco Examiner column that I read into the record last week. It was a week ago this past Wednesday. So if you would like to hear that particular column read, then get a hold of the first part of the archive show from Archives on Audio. What we're going to be doing, what we began doing last week and what we're going to do this week as well, is to take a look at why people do not know what fascism is all about. There are a number of different reasons. First of all, the debasement of our educational system, the deliberate historical obfuscation of the profound connections between very powerful and contemporary interests and fascism. And we're going to begin by taking a look at a fascinating piece of research that was done by a listener. This listener began plowing through dictionaries and obtained two definitions of fascism from the American Heritage Dictionary, copyright 1975, and then from the American Heritage Dictionary from 1993. And as we shall see, American Heritage's dictionary of 1975 had a different spin on fascism than the American Heritage Dictionary of 1993, and we're going to take a look at how the definition of fascism, according to the American Heritage Dictionary, has changed, because it's revealing, and in many ways it serves to highlight why Johnny can't identify Il Duce. By the way, for the purposes of this broadcast, Il Duce, of course, is the nickname for Benito Mussolini, the fascist dictator of Italy. Il Duce can be seen as shorthand for fascism in general. After that, we're going to take a look at an article from the London Independent that was researched for us by Dave White, our pan-European researcher and translator. This article is about the renovation of the reputation of Romanian wartime dictator Antonescu, the head of the fascist collaborationist regime. Actually, not collaborationist. It was a fascist regime that governed wartime Romania and that was allied with Adolf Hitler. As is the case with so many aspects of the history of fascism, that is becoming obscured. Actually, before that, we're going to take a look at an article from today. Today, by the way, for benefit of people who are listening on tape, is Sunday, September 11th of 1994. We're going to take a look at an article talking about the Pope's visit to Croatia. Among the things that the Pope did in Croatia was to lavish praise on Archbishop Alois Stepanak. Archbishop Stepanak was a member of the fascist Ustashi Parliament of wartime Croatia, which was a brutal fascist puppet state of Nazi Germany. They were so brutal they even horrified the SS. Alois Stepanak was actually a member of the wartime Ustashi Parliament, and the Pope was there, that is to say, in Croatia, lavishing praise on this member of a fascist parliament. A good example of the obfuscation, the historical obfuscation of fascism. Alois Stepanak was a dog, a bow-wow of the First Order, not somebody who should be praised by anybody, particularly not one of the world's greatest religious leaders. Not great in a sense of good, but most powerful in this case. We're then going to take a look at an article that appeared in the New York Times this past Friday. This deals with the wartime fascist collaborationist past of a current French Prime Minister François Mitterrand. We dealt with that last week, and in fact, the program last week dealt with wartime France, that is, the France of World War II, and specifically we took a look at François Mitterrand's career as a fascist collaborator before François Mitterrand went to work for the resistance, which he did in 1943. An article appeared in the New York Times this past Friday, which in many ways highlights the historical obfuscation of fascism. The article that I read last week from the San Francisco Chronicle of September 3rd, 1994, talked about François Mitterrand's very close relations with the leaders of the Cagoule. That was a clandestine fascist organization which attempted to overthrow the Democratic Republic of Léon Blum and his Popular Front in 1936, 37, and 38. It collaborated actively with the intelligence services of Nazi Germany and fascist Italy under Il Duce. And many of the leaders of the Cagoule then went on to become prominent leaders of the Vichy fascist government of France after it was occupied by Germany. The New York Times article from last Friday, however, talks about this new book, the Une Jeunesse Française by Pierre Payen, a French author, as to a large extent benefiting the reputation of François Mitterrand, and points out that François Mitterrand was never actually a member of the Cagoule. It should perhaps have said that there's no record of his having formally been a member. That's totally beside the point. The point is he was extremely close with the leaders of this murderous fascist organization, and he maintained that friendship for a long time. And that, in many ways, exemplifies the historical obfuscation of fascism, which is not only continuing to this day, but which unfortunately is accelerating. We're also at that time going to briefly compare the New York Times treatment of François Mitterrand's connections with La Cagoule, or the Hood, or Les Cagoulards, the Hooded Ones, as they are called, by way of contrasting the San Francisco Chronicle coverage of François Mitterrand's fascist past with that presented by America's paper of record, namely the New York Times. Following that, by way of review to a certain extent, and also to further develop the material that I presented last week, because we were limited for time, we're going to go back to a book from 1944, a very rare book, a book most people have never heard of, including most researchers, unfortunately. It's a book called The Triumph of Treason. It's authored by a man named Pierre Cot, last name C-O-T. Pierre Cot was the French Minister of Aviation under the Popular Front of Léon Blum, and we're going to take a look at how the reactionary French generals, some of them just stupid, some of them actively collaborating with fascism, undermined Pierre Cot and other members of the Popular Front's attempts to modernize the French Air Force, in particular to reorganize its tactical disposition. The French Air Force fared very poorly, as did the rest of the French military in the German invasion of 1940, and by way of helping to understand and further develop the arguments that we presented last week, specifically the prominent role of French fascists in deliberately undermining the French resistance to Hitler in 1940. Some of the French collapse was no doubt due to pure stupidity. However, some of it was due to deliberate treachery. There were many members of the French military, as well as the French industrial and financial elite and aristocracy, who very much preferred the prospect of occupation by German fascists than the prospect of having a democratic government governing France, which had liberal participation by socialists, as the Popular Front of Léon Blum had. After that, we're going to delve into the methodological operational structure of fascism and Nazism in particular. We began taking a look at that last week with our examination of La Cagoule, or Les Cagoulards, the French fascist organization which subverted France to a large extent, and with which François Mitterrand was very, very close, although officially at least not necessarily a member. We're going to take a look at another very rare book, a book called Armies of Spies by Joseph Gollum. Joseph Gollum was a very prominent journalist in pre-World War II Europe. He covered the rise of Nazism in Germany, was a prominent anti-fascist journalist, actually very well known in his day, and like so many anti-fascists, virtually unknown in the contemporary period. In 1939, Joseph Gollum, by the way, G-O-L-L-O-M-B is his last name, came out with a book called Armies of Spies about the methodology of fascism, in particular the fifth column movements that Nazi Germany and fascist Italy used to subvert not only the democracies in their own countries, but their neighbors who were targeted for conquest as well. We're going to take a look at Adolf Hitler's conception of Nazi operational methodology as reported by Joseph Gollum in 1939, in particular Hitler's plans of organizing, first of all, an above-ground fascist structure, which is to be accompanied by a very powerful, although altogether clandestine and cellularly organized, underground structure, which was to work with the overground and visible structure. However, it was not to emerge into public view until the time was ready for a takeover. We're also going to review briefly, although I'm not going to read from the text this evening because we have a lot of material on tap, we're going to review some of the discussion from Radio Free America program number 37 about the Third Reich's plans to go underground in anticipation of military defeat. We talked about that in Radio Free America 37. The Third Reich did not disappear, but rather it reorganized, went underground, organized itself in underground cells, which were connected, although largely invisible. Those cells operated very effectively in post-war Germany and were, in effect, a mechanism for control of post-war Germany from what was quite literally a Nazi government in exile, which was able to maintain a very effective control over the, quote, new, unquote, Germany. We talked about that specifically in the August 9th, 1992 installment of Radio Free America number 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War. We came back to that in a big, big, big way in the September 20th, 1992 installment of RFA 37. We're then going to take a look at a very, very important publication, one that I strongly recommend members of the listening audience subscribe to, namely The Searchlight. That is an anti-fascist monthly magazine out of Britain, not to be confused with The Spotlight, which is an American publication of a diametrically opposite political stripe. The Searchlight, the international anti-fascist monthly, has a fascinating and very important article about the underground NSDAP. By the way, NSDAP stands for National Socialista Deutsche Arbeiterpartei. That was the name of the German Nazi Party under Hitler. It's literally the German National Socialist Workers' Party. The so-called neo-Nazis that have been occupying a fair amount of press space in the last couple of years since German reunification, or the last 3 years, are not, in fact, loosely grouped so-called neo-Nazis. A lot of them are young Nazis, popular opinion to the contrary, these groups are part of the same organization. Many of these seemingly disparate Nazi groups in Germany are in fact connected by an underground, centrally organized structure, just as Adolf Hitler proposed in the early 1920s, just as the Nazis, in anticipation of their military defeat, or just as the Third Reich, I should say, in anticipation of their military defeat in World War II, set up. So the contemporary so-called neo-Nazi groups in Germany are in fact directly and profoundly connected to each other through the very type of underground structure that Adolf Hitler proposed in set up in the early 1920s. We're going to take a look at the so-called neo-Nazis of Germany and how, in fact, these seemingly disparate groups are different manifestations of the same very profound organization. And we're going to take a look, too, at elements of continuity between the German fascism of the 1940s, the Hitler period, and the German fascism of today. We're going to rely on the Searchlight's issue of August of 1994 for that information. We're also going to take a look at the September 1994 edition of the Searchlight, and we're going to take a look at Helmut Kohl's selection of a notorious Nazi terrorist in order to represent him at an international consortium of heart specialists. This by way of illustrating something that we have already spoken about, namely that the so-called neo-Nazis of Germany are not just a bunch of punks who are running around raising hell, but in fact are actively supported by the power elements in Germany. Popular opinion to the contrary, notwithstanding. We are then once again going to turn to the Searchlight, this once again from the August 1994 edition of the Searchlight, and we're going to take a look at the swelling Nazi ranks in Austria, because just as the Nazis in Germany are very well organized and directly connected to the power structure in Germany, so too Austrian Nazis are very well organized and have infiltrated the power structure of Austria to a large extent. Obviously, Austria eventually was annexed by Germany and became part of the so-called Fatherland and became an integral part of the Third Reich. History, to a certain extent at least, would appear to be repeating itself. And in fact, fascism is on the march in Austria. And we're going to take a look at the growth of Austrian Nazism as well. And we're going to see some very, very profound parallels between the underground, cellularly organized Nazism of Germany and the underground organizations, the underground Nazi organizations of Austria as well. After that, we're going to swing back over to this side of the Atlantic, and we're going to take a look at something which would, at first glance at least, appear to be completely disparate from our discussion of the history of European fascism. We're going to take a look at some fascinating and, frankly, alarming aspects of the O.J. Simpson murder trial. First of all, we're going to take a look at allegations that have surfaced concerning a Detective Furman, one of the principal figures in the O.J. Simpson investigation. Sources close to O.J. Simpson's defense have alleged that Mark Furman is part of an organization, a cell, perhaps one could say, within the Los Angeles Police Department called Men Against Women, which, according to sources close to the Simpson defense, is basically an Aryan brotherhood, a Nazi group, within the Los Angeles Police Department. Of course, Mark Furman hotly denies this. It is yet to be established as objective fact whether or not Mark Furman is, in fact, a member of a Nazi group, as O.J. Simpson's, or as sources close to O.J. Simpson's defense have been maintaining. It is a matter of public record that many members of the LAPD are members of far right-wing organizations, many of them explicitly Nazi. So the allegations that are being surfaced by the O.J. Simpson defense team should not be taken lightly and should be very carefully examined. Once again, in fairness to Mark Furman, we should offer Mr. Furman, whatever his real affiliations and whatever his actual conduct may be, we should give him the benefit of the doubt that O.J. Simpson has not received. One in the United States is theoretically innocent until proven guilty, and it has not been absolutely established, at least not yet, that Mark Furman is the racist he is alleged to be, or the Nazi that he is alleged to be by some. However, I do think that is something that should not only not be readily dismissed, but should be very carefully investigated. We're also going to take a look at statements allegedly made by Mark Furman that if, quote, he had his way, he'd take all the niggers, put them together in a big group, and burn them, unquote. Whether or not that accurately reflects the sentiments of Mark Furman, that certainly reflects the sentiments of an awful lot of people in this country, including, unfortunately, a lot of elements associated with the Los Angeles Police Department. We're going to take a look at an interesting bend in the road, so to speak, that occurred recently in the O.J. Simpson trial. Attempts by O.J. Simpson's defense team to obtain the police personnel records as well as the military records of Mark Furman were turned down by Judge Lance Ito, the judge that is hearing the O.J. Simpson case. By the way, I'm going to be doing an archive series involving the O.J. Simpson case in weeks to come. I think there are very serious indications that O.J. Simpson was set up. I still, as I've said many times, do not have the definitive proof in that situation. I do not have the answers, but boy, I had questions from the beginning. There's something smelled about this case from the beginning. What O.J. Simpson is alleged to have done seemed highly improbable to me from the beginning. It just did not appear to me that an individual assailant could have done what he is alleged to have done, killed two people with an edged weapon, gotten home, cleaned up, been on an airplane with no visible signs of struggle in as short a period of time as O.J. is alleged to have done what he is alleged to have done. I think the possibility that he was set up should be very seriously investigated. The official version, which is rapidly emerging, namely that O.J. did it, appears to me to be full of holes, and I think there's a very serious possibility, an excellent possibility, that in fact O.J. Simpson was set up with the aid of powerful interests, including perhaps members of the Los Angeles Police Department. The attempts by O.J. Simpson's defense team to obtain the LAPD personnel records and the military records of Mark Furman were turned down by Judge Lance Ito. One of the questions that I have in the O.J. Simpson case concerns the possibility of a deliberately blown defense. One of the things that I found absolutely incredible about the O.J. Simpson trial was the fact that O.J. Simpson's defense team did not request that Judge Ito not be allowed to hear the case. The legal debate in the O.J. Simpson case is going to turn to a considerable extent around the allegations of deliberate police misconduct that I have already alluded to. O.J. Simpson's team has alleged that Detective Furman took one of two bloody gloves that he found at the murder scene and dropped it over at O.J. Simpson's estate. That obviously has not been established, and of course Mark Furman and other members of the LAPD hotly deny that. But in a case where allegations of deliberate police misconduct are going to figure centrally in the legal debate, It does not appear to me that a judge who is married to the highest-ranking female member of the Los Angeles Police Department should be hearing the case. And Judge Ito is married to the highest-ranking female member of the LAPD. He's married to an LAPD police captain. And that, to me, appears to be your basic garden variety conflict of interest. And I, among the many, many questions I have about the O.J. Simpson case concerns why O.J. Simpson's defense team, or alleged defense team, has not challenged having a guy like Judge Ito hear the O.J. Simpson case. It is incredible to me that with Judge Ito married to the highest-ranking female member of the LAPD, he should be hearing a case in which allegations of deliberate misconduct and criminal misconduct on the part of the LAPD will figure centrally in the legal debate. We're going to take a look at a couple of other real funky aspects of the O.J. Simpson case. One of the pieces of evidence upon which the debate is going to turn concerns some ice cream, which was found when the bodies of Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown Simpson were discovered. This ice cream was found largely still frozen sometime after 12:10 in the evening. Now, bear in mind that O.J. Simpson was on a plane that took off at 11:45. There are serious questions about how fast this ice cream would have melted in the 60-degree heat. The bodies were discovered after 12:10 a.m. on the evening of June 13. It says July 13th here. That's a misprint. It should be June 13th in this particular Chronicle account. But the discovery of this still largely unmelted ice cream is obviously a central piece of evidence in determining when Nicole Simpson and Ron Goldman were murdered. An attendant at an ice cream store, a Ben & Jerry's ice cream store in L.A., has testified in the pretrial hearings that Nicole Simpson and an unidentified white male, not Ron Goldman, stopped by this Ben & Jerry's store and picked up ice cream and left. It appears to me to be critical, and I just... appears to me, but a great many other people agree, that this ice cream is one of the central elements in the O.J. Simpson murder investigation. One of the many, many aspects of this case that I find frankly suspicious concerns the handling of the physical evidence by the coroner's department. There is an old expression in the clandestine services, give us the coroner, we'll control the city. And among the many things that happened in the O.J. Simpson investigation, or perhaps alleged investigation might be a better term, because, frankly, this observer finds the prospect that all of the mishandling of evidence was accidental a little bit difficult to believe. I have a healthy respect for human stupidity and human incompetence, and I've no doubt that there's plenty of it in the L.A. coroner's office, but I find it a little hard to believe that there was as much stupidity and as much incompetence as we're being told there was. I suspect at least some of that stupidity and incompetence was deliberate malfeasance. And one of the very strange aspects of the case was that the L.A. coroner's office discarded the gastric contents for Nicole Simpson. They saved it for Ron Goldman, but the contents of Nicole Brown Simpson's stomach were discarded. That is very strange and very unfortunate. One of the main ways that the time of death is established, in addition to checking body temperature, is by examining the stomach contents, because the degree of digestion is, to a certain extent, indicative of the time of death. And obviously, with Nicole Simpson and an unidentified white male having stopped by to pick up ice cream, and that ice cream having been discovered still largely unmelted, the contents of Nicole Simpson's stomach were central to the investigation. They were discarded by the coroner's office. Another aspect to the mishandling of the coroner's evidence that I think should be taken note of was that the bodies of Nicole Simpson and Ron Goldman were kept in unlocked crypts. In other words, for a period of time, anyone could have had access to those bodies. Now, if the allegations that have been surfaced by the O.J. Simpson defense team concerning deliberate police misconduct in a frame-up are correct, and I would add once again that they have not been established, then the possibility that evidence may have been tampered with is one that should be very seriously considered. One of the very strange aspects of the O.J. Simpson case that has yet to receive the attention it deserves concerns the fact that, according to a number of accounts, including one from the San Francisco Chronicle of 7194, 2 days after the murders, a team of Los Angeles police detectives came to the very same store where O.J. Simpson bought a knife, and bought a knife almost identical to the knife that was purchased by O.J. Simpson. Now, if, please note the use of the term, if there is substance to the allegations of police misconduct, and if O.J. was set up with the cooperation of elements of LAPD, the possibility that those unlocked crypts and this almost identical knife could have may figure into the evidence is one that should be very carefully considered. I've been tossing around in my mind various scenarios under which purchasing an almost identical knife would figure into the forensic evidence, and I really cannot come up with a satisfactory explanation. Why not examine the knife itself? Why come up with an almost identical knife? One among the many, many possibilities that I think should be investigated is that perhaps that knife that was purchased by detectives may have been used to inflict wounds on those bodies left in the unlocked crypts. This is only a consideration. I'm not saying that happened, but it is among the possibilities that I think should be very seriously looked into to determine whether, in fact, that did occur. Last item that we're going to be looking at this evening during the prepared portion concerns an allegation that has surfaced with regard to Proposition 187. And by the way, election time is coming up. I strongly encourage members of this listening audience to get involved and to vote, whatever you decide to vote for or whomever you decide to vote for. Please register and please vote. It's interesting that the Secretary of State for the state of California has requested a recess in the O.J. Simpson trial because it is the belief of the Secretary of State and other political observers that the O.J. Simpson case may very well overshadow the elections. And I would add that a low voter turnout will benefit the Republicans. And among the many possibilities I hold open in the O.J. case is that may have, if this was a setup and if there were national security elements involved, and I think that's a possibility that should be very seriously considered, that the effect of this trial on the election is one that should not be too readily dismissed. There is a proposition on the ballot, Proposition 187, which, if it passes, will prohibit illegal immigrants from receiving welfare, schooling, and all but emergency medical services. It is being alleged by a group that is opposed to Proposition 187 that part of the financing for 187 has been provided by the Pioneer Fund. That is an organization that we have dealt with recently on this program. It is an organization that was founded in the pre-Hitler period, and it is specifically a pro-eugenics organization. Members of the Pioneer Fund, from the 1930s to the present time, have long backed or espoused theories of scientific racism. People behind the Pioneer Fund were very close to the eugenics legislation in the United States, which was the model for much of the Third Reich's eugenics legislation. That legislation was the legal foundation for the Third Reich's extermination programs during World War II. And it is being alleged by those who are working against Proposition 187 that the Pioneer Fund, an element of historical continuity from the eugenicists of the pre-World War II and World War II periods to their counterparts today, it has been alleged by opponents of 187 that the Pioneer Fund is helping to finance and back Prop 187. Its backers have hotly denied that. I think this is a very important allegation, one that should be very, very seriously looked into. Wouldn't surprise me a bit. However, I do think that there's more research to be done. The last item in tonight's prepared portion, we're going to review ever so briefly some of the information about the Pioneer Fund and the eugenics legislation which the United States and Nazi Germany held in common. We're not going to dwell on it because we've dealt with it in the recent past, but we are going to touch on it once again. That's what we have on tap for tonight's... That's what we have on tap for the prepared portion of tonight's program. What we're going to do next is take a musical break. When we come back, the main body of the prepared portion of One Step Beyond. Before proceeding with the main body of the prepared portion of One Step Beyond, I would like to pass on some information about a new organization that has been formed. Over the years, over the some 15 years that I've been doing these broadcasts, I have been approached periodically by people who either believe they are under mind control or are under mind control and have been subjected to mind control, or people who know of others who have been subjected to mind control. Mind control is a subject that is often ridiculed by the naive. Unfortunately, mind control has been a focus of U.S. national security activity for many, many years. And there is an organization that has been formed to attempt to help people who have been placed under mind control. This is an organization that you can join. If you would like to contact this organization for any reason, I'm going to give you the particulars on this right now. The organization was formed by Walter Bowart, last name B-O-W-A-R-T, a name very well known to the listeners to One Step Beyond. Walter Bowart is the author of Operation Mind Control, arguably the best single book about mind control. And Walter Bowart has formed an organization called the Freedom of Thought Foundation. It's dedicated to protecting the logo of the organization, or the slogan is dedicated to protecting all from mind control. If you would like to contact and or join the Freedom of Thought Foundation, you can contact them at Post Office Box 35072, P.O. Box 35072, Tucson, Arizona, 85740-5072. The email number is, or the email is, they can be contacted by email at freethought@AOL.com. That's FREETHOT at AOL.com. In addition to Walter Bowart, the advisory board has Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, formerly Air Force focal point officer and in charge of special operations for the Joint Chiefs of Staff under President Kennedy, the author of The Secret Team, the CIA and its allies in control of the world. Arguably it's certainly one of the very best books about the U.S. intelligence community. Once again, the Freedom of Thought Foundation is at P.O. Box 35072, Tucson, Arizona, 85740-5072. The email number, freethought, F-R-E-E-T-H-O-T, at AOL.com. Okay? All righty. And speaking of freedom of thought, that's something that the powers that be in this country do not, I'm afraid, want people to have. And we're going to kick off the main body of the prepared portion of tonight's program, the second part of a two-part archive series called Why Johnny Can't Identify Il Duce. Again, that was the title of a San Francisco Examiner column that I read into the record last week. For our purposes, Il Duce can be understood to mean fascism in general. Last week, we took a look at several different reasons why Johnny or Janie can't identify Il Duce. For one thing, the educational system itself has been debased to the point where, frankly, the average American can't tell a dirt road from a chicken with lips. Beyond that, the one step beyond that, so to speak, the fact that many very powerful interests, very prestigious interests, were in fact very supportive of Hitler and Mussolini, has been deliberately obscured by history and by journalism. Not only powerful industrialists and financiers, many of America's best-known corporations, not only were they behind fascism to a considerable extent, but the Vatican, as we shall see, was very supportive of fascism in the pre-World War II period, and to a large extent they collaborated with fascism during and after World War II as well. Now, when I say the Vatican, I mean the Vatican, not necessarily the Catholic Church as a whole. Beyond that, fascism itself has for many years pursued a deliberately clandestine methodological procedure. As we took a look at last week and as we shall examine again this week, fascism has organized itself in a clandestine fashion and has proceeded in a clandestine fashion. The methodology of fascism is identical and at one with that of intelligence agencies, and that also, the clandestine methodological structure and operational structure of fascism has had much to do with the fact that Johnny or Janie can't identify Il Duce, because Il Duce, or fascism, has operated in a clandestine fashion. It has operated out of view so that people do not understand it. And by way of helping to deepen our understanding of why Johnny or Janie can't identify Il Duce, we're going to take a look at a fascinating piece of research done by a listener. Research credit on this, of course, goes to a listener. This listener took a look at the American Heritage Dictionary, copyright 1975, and then the American Heritage Dictionary, copyright 1993. First, I'm going to read the definition of fascism from the American Heritage Dictionary of 1975. Fascism, noun. First definition, a philosophy or system of government that advocates or exercises a dictatorship of the extreme right, typically through the merging of state and business leadership together with an ideology of belligerent nationalism. One more time. A philosophy or system of government that advocates or exercises a dictatorship of the extreme right, typically through the merging of state and business leadership together with an ideology of belligerent nationalism. In our first two Radio Free America shows, as well as the miscellaneous archive show called Uncle Sam and Il Duce, American Support for Mussolini and the Mythology of the Corporate State, we took a look at Mussolini's definition of fascism as, quote, corporatism, unquote. The fact of the matter is that fascism is an extreme right-wing dictatorship. This is among the things that has been obscured historically. There are an awful lot of people who really do not know what fascism is. I've heard people describe the Stalinist totalitarian system of the Soviet Union as fascist. It's not. Totalitarian, yes. Fascist, no. We're going to, before we ruminate a little further about just what fascism is, let's take a look at how the definition of fascism as relayed by the American Heritage Dictionary has changed between 1975, which I just read you, and 1993. Reading from the American Heritage Dictionary, copyright 1993, fascism, noun, first definition, a system of government marked by a totalitarian dictator, socioeconomic controls, suppression of the opposition, and usually a policy of belligerent nationalism and racism. And the B definition provided here, a political philosophy or movement based on or advocating such a system. And said definition 2, oppressive dictatorial control. Nowhere in the definition of fascism provided by the American Heritage Dictionary of 1993 is fascism identified as a right-wing system, because it is a right-wing system. This, I think, is indicative of how the true nature of fascism has been deliberately obscured, because in point of fact, very powerful interests, powerful corporate interests, powerful national security interests, powerful political interests, powerful intellectual interests have backed fascism. And as the United States and many other countries in the world hurtle to the right, and we are swinging very rapidly to the right, have been moving in that direction for a long time, many of the interests that backed Hitler and Mussolini and many of the interests that are backing the onset of fascism today do not want fascism to be associated in the popular consciousness with the right wing. Well, the fact of the matter, it is. As regular listeners to this program know, I do not consider myself a leftist, although I am generally considered part of the left. You talk about the things I talk about, and most people will consider you, frankly, a screaming commie. But I do not hold a brief for the left wing. In fact, as regular listeners to this program know, I'm very critical of the left, which, in my opinion, is the best friend the fascists of the right wing have ever had. The right wing and the left wing, in my opinion, are two different clefts on a horse's rear end, and the end product of both is, well, frankly, it's the end product. And you know what I mean by that. The fact, however, that I'm critical of the left, and I'm fiercely critical of the left, is often misunderstood by conservative or right-wing listeners to indicate that I am a right-winger. I am most assuredly not. The left wing, in my experience, produces idiots, weaklings, and hypocrites. The right wing produces fascism. The right wing produced Hitler. The right wing produced Mussolini, and it's producing the same goddamn thing in this country today. And that's one of the reasons, I suspect, why the American Heritage Dictionary of 1993 does not identify fascism as a right-wing system of government, which it most assuredly is. Kudos to that listener for digging that up for us. A fascinating bit of research. Among the many powerful interests that have been supportive of fascism in the past and that, frankly, are supportive of fascism in the present, concerns the Vatican. In Radio Free America program number 17, entitled Fascism and the Vatican, we took a look at the profound historical relationship between the Vatican and fascism. Now, Catholic members of the audience should not misunderstand my identification of the Vatican as pro-fascist, which, frankly, it was in the pre-World War II and World War II periods, and frankly, it has been to a large extent in the post-World War II period, to mean that the Catholic Church per se is pro-fascist. In fact, many Catholic priests and many practicing Catholics were victims of fascism prior to and during World War II, just as in places like Latin America, Catholic prelates have often been the victims of fascist death squads and fascist activity. Unfortunately, the Vatican has often betrayed those practitioners of Catholicism who have fallen beneath the scythe of fascism. And one among the many powerful interests and the many prestigious interests that have supported the monstrous dictatorships of fascism in the past and that to a certain extent continue to do so, among those elements is the Vatican. In Radio Free America 17, we took a look at Cardinal Eugenio Pacelli, or then Archbishop Eugenio Pacelli, who went on to become Pope Pius XII. He, according to Paul Murphy, the author of La Popessa, was channeling church money to Adolf Hitler as papal nuncio to Munich, Germany in 1919. The Pacelli family, including then-Cardinal Eugenio Pacelli, was instrumental in forming the Lateran Treaty of 1929, which made Roman Catholicism the state religion of Benito Mussolini's fascist Italy, and also laid the groundwork for the Vatican financial structures, which erupted into scandal in the 1980s. We took a look at the Vatican financial scandals in Radio Free America number 18. Fascism continued to be very supportive, or the Vatican, I should say, continued to be very supportive of fascism. And in fact, the reverse was true, too. Fascism was very supportive of the Vatican. Although Pius XI was very critical of fascism, he died in a rather untimely fashion. He was replaced by Pope Pius XII, formerly Eugenio Pacelli, an intimate of fascism from his days as an archbishop in Munich. And the endorsement and the kid glove treatment given to German fascism by Pius XII was reciprocated by Adolf Hitler, who set up the Kirchensteuer, or the church tax, which remained intact in Germany right up through the 1980s. The Kirchensteuer, or church tax, actually appropriated a certain percentage of every German wage earner's income and gave it to various religious organizations, including and especially the Catholic Church. So it was something of a quid pro quo. Many of the top Nazis were helped to escape by being given Vatican passports, and indeed the Vatican was instrumental in setting up the so-called rat line, which permitted many top Nazi war criminals to escape. Many of those escapees eventually went to work for Western intelligence, U.S. intelligence, and the CIA in particular. The individual responsible for giving those passports to many of these top Nazis was then Cardinal Giovanni Battista Montini, who later became better known as Pope Paul VI. And Pope Paul VI helped to form the very close cooperative pattern between the Vatican and the Propaganda Due Lodge of Licio Gelli, a prominent supporter of Mussolini and a former Waffen-SS officer. Licio Gelli's P2 Lodge continues to cast a very long shadow over Italy to this day.